Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today, we're picking up where we left off with Unraveling the Fabric of Fear. We've worked through the earlier parts, and now we're tackling Chapter 10. It's called The Sin System Conundrum. This chapter really takes a hard look at traditional ideas of sin, you know, and how we react to what the book calls disharmonious actions.
Yeah, so our goal today is to unpack that. We'll be looking at some, well, challenging ideas around blame, justice, and the whole web of causes behind why people do what they do.
And we'll see how concepts from earlier chapters kind of weave back in here. We'll also touch briefly on some religious perspectives mentioned.
Okay, sounds good. Getting started. The chapter dives right into defining sin. It brings up John Oakes and the words roots.
Yeah, the Hebrew cheta, which apparently means to miss the way. And then there's the Greek hamartia, which comes from archery, you know, meaning to miss the mark.
That's a really interesting starting point, isn't it? Missing the mark, not inherent evil. It shifts the focus.
It does. And the chapter immediately links that to its main argument, that these disharmonious actions aren't done by fundamentally bad people.
Right. It suggests they come from, you know, basically good people who've absorbed these less than ideal thought patterns from the culture around them. A kind of environmental conditioning.
Which really pushes back against just slapping labels on people like sinner or criminal. The chapter argues that can actually be, well, counterproductive if we don't look at causes and effects.
Yeah, and it brings in that powerful quote from Catherine Hoke via Tim Ferriss. She makes a distinction, doesn't she, between working with people who committed criminal acts and calling them criminals.
Exactly. That language matters. Avoiding those fixed labels seems key to her approach.
And forgiveness, too, right? Hoke emphasizes forgiveness.
She does. And if you see these actions as learned behaviors, maybe you learned responses to difficult situations, then forgiveness and the potential for change become, well, much more central to the discussion. It's less about condemnation.
Mm-hmm. More about understanding and maybe even rehabilitation in a broader sense. And that connects to the next point, the idea of violence as a contagious epidemic from Gary Slutkin.
Right, this public health perspective. Slutkin suggests we should treat violence like, say, cholera or TB with intervention, empathy, support, not just moral judgment.
Which fits perfectly with the missing the mark idea, doesn't it? If it's learned, like a disease spreading, then the treatment should focus on interrupting that spread and helping people find a different path.
Precisely. So that's the groundwork.
Yeah.
Look beyond labels, consider causes, think about supportive intervention, and then the chapter really digs into what it calls our conditioned system, the disharmonious thought pattern factory.
Okay, the factory idea. This is where it argues our society itself, the structures we live in, often end up creating and reinforcing these problematic ways of thinking.
Yeah, it paints this picture of a cycle, largely driven by the fear of economic loss. That fundamental anxiety.
And that fear, the chapter suggests, fuels this constant scramble for economic influence, which has knock-on effects.
Definitely, like what it calls mass grooming, using public fears and anxieties to push consumerism. How does the source explain how these patterns get learned from culture?
It quotes Paul Mazur back in the 20s, talking about shifting America from needs to desires, and Charles Kettering from GM saying, keep the consumer dissatisfied. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty blunt, this idea of deliberately engineering discontent to fuel the economy. It mentions a specific figure, Edward Bernays.
Ah, yes. Bernays, often called the father of public relations, though maybe a pioneer of social engineering is more accurate, using psychology to shape public opinion.
Right. And the source links him to a big cultural shift.
It does. It highlights how he was instrumental in shifting Western culture, particularly in the U.S., from being mainly needs-based to being desires-based.
How did he do that?
Through, well, sophisticated advertising and marketing, using emotional triggers, tapping into our social nature, our psychological vulnerabilities to make people want things.
Not just things they needed, but new things all the time.
Exactly. The goal was deliberate. Train people to desire new stuff before the old stuff was even worn out. Create this sort of permanent state of wanting, of dissatisfaction, really, keeping the consumer engine running.
So how does Bernays connect back to the main sin system idea?
It's a powerful example, isn't it? It shows that culture isn't just this passive thing we live in. It actively teaches us values, shapes our desires, our behavior.
So if culture can be deliberately engineered to promote, say, constant wanting, or maybe competition fueled by envy.
Or even manipulate us towards in-group thinking or emotional reactions over logic, then it really strengthens that argument, doesn't it? Disharmonious actions like maybe excessive consumption or certain kinds of conflict are learned patterns. They're heavily influenced by the environment, the conditioning.
Yeah, it makes that idea, no inherently bad people just learned patterns, feel much more concrete when you see how culture itself can be, well, programmed.
Absolutely. It underlines the source's point about actions stemming from exposure and learning within a specific system rather than some unchangeable flaw inside the person. And this economic drive inevitably influences government policy, especially in a competitive market. Governments are players too, right?
Right. And the chapter argues even things like education and the prison system can get pulled into feeding this competitive economic model.
Then there's the political side. The struggle for political power often discourages forgiveness, doesn't it? It's all about winning, defeating the opponent.
That adversarial language, yeah. Compromise and forgiveness don't always fit well in that kind of framework.
So you have this competitive economy, which by definition creates winners and losers. And the chapter argues this has real psychological, even physiological and sociological effects.
It does. It connects poverty, whether relative or absolute, to tangible problems like public health issues, but also cognitive deficits.
It mentions a few studies here, one from Harvard on healthy food costs being higher, making it harder for poorer families. Another from Columbia suggesting brain structure differences in kids from different socioeconomic backgrounds.
And that University of Warwick study about financial stress actually reducing IQ points, that's pretty significant.
It really is. It suggests poverty isn't just about lacking stuff. The chronic stress itself takes a toll on your thinking.
And beyond the economic, there's the social status aspect. Perceiving yourself, or being perceived, as lower value has negative psychological effects. It mentions studies on social hierarchies, even in monkeys, showing dopamine level differences.
So our place in the social pecking order seems to directly impact our brain chemistry and well-being.
Which leads to things like class separation, geographic clustering, you know, rich areas here, poor areas there, often near industrial zones.
And marketing jumps right on that, right?
Mm-hmm.
The luxury effect targeted at some, budget options clustered elsewhere, it sort of reinforces the divisions.
The chapter also briefly touches on our herd instinct, quoting Vasily Klucherov, who says our brains might even flag disagreeing with a group as an error.
That makes us vulnerable, doesn't it, to manipulation in marketing and politics, playing on that need to fit in.
Definitely. And this leads into the government and business connection. The chapter suggests they're often deeply intertwined.
It quotes Peter Joseph on tariffs maybe protecting specific industries, not just the broad economy. And Ayn Rand, surprisingly perhaps, arguing monopolies often result from government collusion, not pure free markets.
Yeah, and the complexities around free trade deals, it makes you ask, you know, whose freedom, whose benefit?
And it backs this up with that Gielens and Page study. Their finding was pretty stark, wasn't it? That average Americans have almost zero impact on policy compared to economic elites and organized groups.
It suggests a system where economic power translates very directly into political influence.
Thorstein Veblen comes in here too. His view was that modern politics is business politics, basically government as a protector of property rights above all else.
Right. And Veblen's point that negative side effects, externalities, often get ignored by the market as long as it's considered sound business management.
Oof. Yeah. A pretty critical take on how the system operates. So, okay, that's the factory of the system producing these thought patterns. Then the chapter looks at the effects of our reactions, mm-hmm. how we respond to the outcomes.
And this is where it really critiques our usual approaches. It argues we tend to treat the behavior, the sin, as just an individual failing, ignoring all those systemic pressures we just discussed.
We focus on the symptom, not the cause.
Kind of, yeah. And it specifically critiques what it calls the social disconnection solution, things like prison.
Right, locking people away.
Yeah. The chapter argues that while it might seem targeted, it often has huge unintended negative ripple effects, economic costs, emotional trauma for families, social stresses that spread far beyond the individual.
It uses that archery analogy again, doesn't it? If you shoot multiple arrows to hit the target once, haven't you effectively missed with all the others?
Exactly. And if our approach to dealing with someone who missed the mark ends up harming lots of other people, their kids, their community, are we not also missing the mark pretty badly with our response, like a scatter bomb instead of a targeted strike?
That's a powerful image. It mentions that Defy Venture statistic too, about the high percentage of kids with incarcerated parents ending up incarcerated themselves. It shows how these cycles can just keep going. I remember seeing a mention of the fundamental attribution error.
Ah, yes, absolutely. That's a key connection.
Remind us what that is again.
Sure. It's that common mental shortcut, or error, really, where we see someone do something, especially something unethical or wrong, and we immediately blame their character.
Like, oh, they did that because they're a bad person.
Exactly. We jump to judging their personality, they're lazy, they're dishonest, without properly considering the situation, the context, the pressures they might be under.
Right. We overestimate personality and underestimate the situation.
Precisely. And the source argues quite strongly that our criminal justice system often leans heavily on this error. Well, it tends to isolate the individual's action.
Right.
It treats people almost like free agents acting in a void, often downplaying or dismissing the wider biosocial conditions that might have shaped that behavior.
Biosocial conditions. You mean like their biology, their upbringing, their environment, social factors?
All of that, yeah. The whole complex mix, which brings up a huge question, doesn't it?
Yep.
How do we minimize that collateral damage, especially in a society where everything's so interconnected?
Yeah, the source raises that explicitly and says it's for a later discussion. You know, what is the right way to correct behavior without causing more harm? It's a massive challenge.
Which brings us then to those religious perspectives that are included. The point isn't religious endorsement.
No, it's framed as examples of like pre-scientific psychological insights, right? People observing human nature long before modern psychology.
So it gives a few quick examples.
There's Christianity, Matthew and Luke, about, you know, checking your own faults before pointing fingers, not judging too quickly.
Uh-huh. Then Islam, from the Quran and Hadith, emphasizing patience, forgiveness, the idea that God's forgiveness reflects how we should forgive.
Buddhism, too, from the Dhammapada, how easily we spot others' flaws but hide our own. That seems universal.
It does. And Hinduism, from the Bhagavad Gita and Mahabharata, talking about controlling the mind to avoid harmful actions, not seeking revenge, finding peace internally.
And even other spiritual sources, like the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, mention fear's origin and how cause and effect are linked, urging us to aim for better outcomes. So these ancient texts from different traditions are basically echoing the chapter's core arguments about judgment and compassion.
In their own language, with that same core idea. Why do we stray? Why is self-awareness hard? Why are compassion and forgiveness important? What are the results of harmful actions? It all resonates with that idea of falling short of a desired way of being.
Hmm.
They provide this historical ancient wisdom that supports the idea that just judging, blaming, and condemning others goes against deeper principles of mercy, self-awareness, and compassion.
So these ancient traditions were already exploring the nuances of human behavior, the reasons we miss the mark, long before we called it psychology or sociology.
That seems to be the chapter's point in including them, showing a kind of historical continuity in thinking about these problems.
Okay, so that was quite a deep dive into the sin system conundrum. Let's try and sum up the key takeaways.
We saw how the chapter reframes sin not as inherent evil, but as missing the mark.
Yeah, and it really challenges us for condemning individuals without fully considering the causes behind their actions.
Mm-hmm. Using those analogies like the archer and the scatterbomb to make us question the collateral damage potentially caused by our reactions and systems.
We brought in psychological concepts like the fundamental attribution error.
The complex chain of causality, mm-hmm. How conditioning and environment shape behavior.
And contrasted blame with the potential of forgiveness and unconditional compassion.
Right, and linking it all to that idea of the illusion of adulthood, that we're all still learning, and even showing real-world links, like the Cathartic Curiosity Project.
And finally, seeing how these modern-sounding ideas actually echo ancient wisdom traditions.
Yeah, the core message seems to be that, you know, hate breeds hate, but compassion can breed compassion. True understanding looks for the why, not just the what.
It certainly does. It leaves you wondering, doesn't it? If we really take these systemic factors seriously, how should our approaches to justice and maybe even social reform change? What would that look like?
A big question to ponder.
Indeed. Well, that brings us to the end of this fascinating exploration.
Stay curious, question everything, stay compassionate, keep diving deeper.